you're breeding Dalmatian mice, writing award-winning plays, or winning the U.S. Tennis Nationals 3 years in a row, you have two things: a busy schedule and high standards. Now, I haven't written a book on the subject, but I know a thing or two about drinking coffee that not only meets the high standards, but that also makes your life easier. You know I'm talking about Sparkplug Coffee. The most discerning coffee drinkers know that the secret to the best cup of coffee is starting with fresh roasted beans, but there's no way to know when the coffee you buy at the grocery store or the local cafe was roasted. So when Sparkplug Coffee delivers you premium Arabica beans that have been directly sourced and fairly traded, they promise that it will reach your home or office within a week of being custom roasted here in Toronto so that it's always fresh and at its peak flavor. Sparkplug even offers autopilot, set it and forget it delivery so that you'll never run out of fresh coffee again. Sparkplug offers blends to suit any taste, including decaf and half-caf, so plug yourself in at sparkplugcoffee.com. I think I would have written that more in the Tenenbaum style, but, you know, what's the point if you can't get Alec Baldwin to read it?
He's pretty busy. Wait, that was my Batman voice.
Yeah, that was awful.
He's Batman-esque.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Top 100.
Project.
And action.
Happy 2017, movie men and women, and maybe children, but probably not children for a podcast. Let's root for this year to kick the shit out of a pretty raggedy 2016. Let's hope there are no children listening after saying the word shit. So here begins our second year of Next 100 Project Movies after a bunch of years reviewing AFI classics. Warning right now, we've been known to spoil 2 or 22 movies from time to time. I am Royal Ryan Ellis, and my wife, who used to be a smoker, and I think she should quit. Well, she's Bev.
That's me.
Good thing you quit before I even met you.
So it's true.
Wasn't really everywhere you were a smoker, apart from you telling me. All right, the coming attraction trivia for the Royal Tenenbaums. How many previous 44 Next 100 Project movies saw their title character or characters dead by the end of the movie? Very dark question to start the year.
So specifically, these are movies we've covered since we finished the Top 100 Project, right?
The 44 right? We've
okay.
covered,
yeah. Okay, yeah. Carrie?
Yep.
Spoilers alert, by the way.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Terminator 2?
Both the Terminators.
Both, also, well, yeah, like whether you, whichever one you count to be yeah. the Terminator, they're both yeah. dead, and Thelma and Louise.
Right. But I said last week, actually, this gets a little bit dicey because, well, not last week, but the podcast that previewed this one. So I counted 3 and almost 5. The Reservoir Dogs, almost all of them are dead.
But that was just a name he gave to the movie. They weren't the Reservoir Dogs. There's no point in the movie where they're like, we call ourselves the Reservoir Dogs.
A lot of movies would have said that, too.
That is not... So I saw that, and I know what you're saying, but I disagree with the premise.
And Lou Gehrig in The Pride of the Yankees is not quite dead. That came later. And then, arguably, Thelma and Louise aren't even dead when the movie's over. They're still hanging there in midair. But they're probably not going to last.
Yeah, I think they're as good as dead. Come
the
on,
the Grand
now.
Canyon's going to kill them.
They just didn't show it. They're dead.
You've got
Speaking of Thelma and Louise, we have to like give a shout-out because Thelma and Louise just got added to the National Film Registry
right.
this year.
Mm-hmm.
So kudos. We reminded ourselves this year was an excellent film, totally worth revisiting.
If we do cover anything else that made the National Film Registry in 2016 and this year, then we'll certainly mention that. We haven't really had that many lately that made the NFR.
We are definitely covering one this year that made the list.
The Princess Bride.
The Princess Bride.
Very conceivable. Okay, a little bit more before we get into the Royal Tenenbaums podcast about the death thing, about our AFI movies, which of course are long since done. So 13 of those title characters, almost 19, die. King Kong, Citizen Kane, The Third Man, African Queen, because it's the boat, and it sinks, it dies.
Okay, fair.
Shane, debatable, does he die or not? Maybe he does, maybe
he doesn't.
Okay, Spartacus, who's minutes away from death, not dead when the movie's over, though. The Manchurian Candidate, unless the real Manchurian Candidate is Ben Marco, Frank Sinatra's character.
Ooh.
Lawrence of Arabia, so Lawrence is dead. Dr. Zhivago, Bonnie and Clyde, both, The Wild Bunch, all of them. Easy Rider, all three of the characters we care about in that movie. Butch Cassidy, Sundance Kid, The Godfather. Well, one of them dies. The title character, Godfather, Marlon Brando's version, not so much Pacino. Jaws, The Shark, Cuckoo's Nest, The One, which is Nicholson. Taxi Driver, which we've talked about plenty of times. Is he really dead? Is it a fantasy? But if it's the fantasy, then he's dead. Sophie's Choice and Amadeus, they're not debatable. They
did you say Bonnie and Clyde?
Died. I did. So 13, but arguably 19 in the AFI movies.
So if you want your film to be considered a classic, it's going to help your odds if you do away with your lead character.
Great death scenes, too, in those. The Godfather obviously has one of the more famous ones. Kong dying the way he does, Kane, the boat sinking in African Queen, the shark being blown up in Jaws, the way that Nicholson is strangled to death by the pillow in Cuckoo's Nest. Yeah, death scenes make for classic movies very often. But let's get off the death theme again, some fun, because this is a funny movie. And it is the Next 100 Project's 45th motion picture, The Royal Tenenbaums, which was not nominated for any AFI Top 100 lists. Not a one. After screening at the New York Film Festival in October 2001, Touchstone Pictures gave the flick a proper release in the very early days of 2002, so in a way, this is the 15th anniversary. But really, it is a 2001 movie. It more than doubled its budget in America alone, so it did okay, especially by Wes Anderson's standards. All right, Bev, explain the movie that's now 15-plus years old, almost 16, with the skinny.
Gene Hackman is the title character, minus the S, a broke and disgraced New York litigator who lies and fake cancers his way back into his family's life after his long-suffering estranged wife, played by Angelica Houston, gets engaged. His three very messed-up grown children are played by Ben Stiller, Luke Wilson, and Gwyneth Paltrow.
The old fake cancer gambit. Or, in a nutshell, deadbeat dad dead. Progeny prospers. Probably. Entitled assholes.
Oh, yeah. We'll talk about that.
They're pretty entitled. All right, the Rotten Tomatoes scores. 80% of the critics like the movie, 161 fresh, but 40 rotten, and 89% of audiences. The movie was 48th at the 2001 U.S. box office. Harry Potter, the first one, and Lord of the Rings, the first one, were number one and number two that year. And, of course, The Beautiful Mind won Best Picture. But all that aside, as we talk now about The Royal Tenenbaums, Bev, what are your thoughts?
I love, love, love this movie.
Three loves.
Yeah, it's my favorite Wes Anderson movie.
Me too.
I think it's aging phenomenally. It's as moving as it is delightful, and that's saying a lot because it is so damn delightful.
I like his movies. We've seen a few in the theater, deliberately paid that extra money rather than waiting for home video because he's one of those guys you want to see on the big screen. He deserves that. But at the same point, I don't love very many of the movies he's actually made. I'm not a big Rushmore guy. Never have been. I've seen it twice, maybe even three times. Bottle Rocket was okay. I know Scorsese was a big fan of that one. Mid-90s, I believe that came out.
Well,
that was the one.
It's a crime movie. It's like the only crime movie he ever made, really.
Put Anderson and Owen Wilson, for that matter, on the map. But this and Grand Budapest Hotel are my two favorite Wes Anderson films. And maybe because the lead characters in both cases are not typical comedians who are hysterical. Gene Hackman in this and Ralph Fiennes in Grand Budapest.
So, I love Grand Budapest Hotel, but it's the most Wes Anderson-iest movie of all of Wes Anderson's movies, and it's almost overkill, but it's just hysterical enough because it's so funny. What's missing from Grand Budapest Hotel, and the reason that I like Royal Tenenbaums better enough to call it my favorite Wes Anderson film, is that it feels a little cold, it feels a little detached. I don't feel like that warmth and that pathos from the characters that I do from Royal Tenenbaums. I like Bottle Rocket. I certainly don't love it. And from Bottle Rocket to Grand Budapest Hotel, he just keeps getting more and more deep into his own style and his own over-the-top set production and very particular and meticulous mise-en-scène and direction.
That's very true.
But it feels like it went from the indie kind of budget film to the higher budget films. And somewhere in between Royal Tenenbaums was the Goldilocks movie, where it still cares enough about character, but it has a big enough budget and he's accomplished enough and practiced enough in his style to make it a very twee. I'll use the word twee, which I'll probably use a lot. I mean, the word was practically invented to describe Wes Anderson films, but all that detail and the music and just the feeling that it gives you, the knickknacks and the detail, and I almost want to say nostalgia of it because there's so many vintage things that are just familiar enough to feel like they're part of our lifetime, even if it's something you don't recognize yourself. There's something about the presence of his movies that are so overwhelmingly charming and very specific to him. Tenenbaums is the perfect blend of his style, which is great, and characters that we care about, and an excellent script. I think it's probably the best script he's ever worked with.
Nominated for the Oscar, Wilson and Anderson, the only nomination this movie got, and how did it not get an art direction?
Come on.
Maybe even costumes, but certainly for the sets. But then he rarely has been nominated for those things, even though if you're going to call him twee, that implies that the sets and the costumes, although maybe it's too twee for the voters, but they should have been recognized a lot over the years. The way that so many movies that are set in the 1200s, the 1400s, with old English costumes or Roman costumes, they've won or been nominated so many times. But this guy's hit the nail on the head so often with the great sets, the house in Tenenbaums, the boat in Life Aquatic, one of my favorite sets in any movie ever, and of course the hotel in Grand Budapest Hotel, and even the train in Darjeeling Limited. I'm not a huge fan of Darjeeling Limited, but that's also a great set. And also an opportunity for him to do the dollhouse thing where it goes along, you see all the people in the compartments of it, just like you see that in the boat in Life Aquatic. That's what he does. There's a part of me that understands when people criticize somebody for that, a director or a filmmaker, writer, producer, an actor, whoever, for doing the same things all the time and not really branching off too much. Hitchcock's been criticized for that. But if that's what you do, then you want to do the thing that you like to do the best. Why try to make a movie that isn't you? Why is he going to make a horror film or a typical kind of comedy for Hollywood when he wants to make these movies that delve into all kinds of things, including horrific elements? Not horror, but he often is killed off his main character, like in the two movies we just said, Tenenbaums and Grand Budapest. Off-screen, in fact, Hackman dies after the ambulance scene because he's still alive when we see him, and then he's just in a grave. And that really should be a sad ending, but he finds a way to make them either bittersweet or even funny at the end. Usually bittersweet, though.
It's almost like he's writing a children's storybook, but with very adult themes and with very adult endings. He's kind of a nihilist. He doesn't believe good guys always win. He doesn't believe some benign force is looking after his characters. If there's a war going on, as in the case in Grand Budapest Hotel, these characters are genuinely in danger, and lots of people needlessly, senselessly died for no reason during, I think it's World War One, or is it World War II in Grand Budapest Hotel?
I haven't seen it in a while. I think it's two. Let's say two.
I want to say two. Yeah, I think it's World War II. He just is one of those throwaway deaths that happens all the time in war. He gets stopped at a checkpoint and argues with the wrong person and buys it. Or even like Royal Tenenbaum just having an ill-timed heart attack. Although it's not ill-timed because it comes just in time for him to have made up with his family and potentially saved his family from their own dysfunctions that he himself also caused. This is what Wes Anderson does, and I like how you say, I don't need him to stretch himself. There are some directors who are extremely adept at doing all kinds of different things. The name that comes to mind is Steven Soderbergh, who's made just about every kind of film you can imagine. Stanley Kubrick, he can make any kind of film and make it amazing and make it interesting and make it his. Wes Anderson makes Wes Anderson films, and they're always about families, they're always about relationships, they're always about the leisure class, you know, they're always about wealthy people. Well, I guess Rushmore is an exception, sort of. It's also about a private school, which is certainly something I'm sure Wes Anderson is pretty familiar with.
The secondary character is pretty rich, Bill Murray.
Yes, absolutely. He makes movies that are really heavily art-directed. They're tableaus that he makes. They're dioramas. It's like somebody pays him to make these elaborate dioramas. And that's okay. There's lots of directors where that's the case, and you look for that from them, and you expect that from them. And his big competitor for the Oscars the year that Grand Budapest Hotel came out, which was definitely the most praised movie he's ever made as far as like critics, was Richard Linklater with Boyhood. And they're both these, even though Richard Linklater has much more range, I would say, but when they're at their best, they're making movies that are really strongly in their own wheelhouse. And I think that's okay.
I agree completely. Let's get into the story a little bit more now, though. You just said about Royal dying at the end and how maybe that does make people better. At least you implied that. I think Royal's presence does make them all better. He's a fun pappy, at the very least, with the grandkids. He's one of those guys that can connect with the grandchildren, not so much the children. I've had that happen to my family before. Some men are just better at the grandchildren thing, especially if they fucked up things with their kids.
And women, too, mothers and fathers. Yeah, it's just true. Lower stakes with your own grandchildren. Mm.
And also, Royal is both the shit and also the likable, funny guy. The whole thing where he tells Ethel he's dying of cancer and then says, I'm not dying, and she slugs him. Well, I am dying.
Yeah, he's like fly-by-night, laissez-faire style parenting. And life in general, it's both hurt his children so much that they've retreated into their own private dysfunctions, but it's that same brazen playfulness that gets them out of their slump.
Isn't it interesting, too, that the three kids who are so talented, the young geniuses that they were, and they kind of peak early, but then they still have talent. I guess they peaked way too early, arguably, but then when the movie's over, again, maybe because of Royal's prodding the way he was, that they get back to doing things the way they had done before, maybe even getting better, who knows? But anyway, the kids represent economics with Stiller, the arts with Paltrow, and athletics with Luke Wilson. And that kind of runs the gamut of things that most people get into. I mean, there's obviously all kinds of jobs you can have, but those are the three main areas that most people go into, especially those who might actually be successful in a well-known way, a world-renowned way, and making money.
Yeah, and perhaps it's a commentary on early success and how that can set you up to fail. each character who creates in any way receives somewhat harsh criticism eventually. Like, Richie fails to develop as an artist, and they say when he's, like, painting all his pictures of Margot, and Eli is very specifically not a genius. One of the best laughs in the movie when he's on the phone with a critic saying, why do you specifically have to go out of your way to say I'm not a genius? Well, you didn't even have to think about it. And then we learn, of course, that it's Margot on the other end of the phone. And in the happy ending, Margot is writing her new play, and they specifically say it receives mixed reviews.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like everybody gets this elaborately happy ending at the end. Actually, what they have to come to terms with is that their early success is not how they should be measuring their lives anymore, because the fact that they could never keep those heights is part of what ruined them.
Richie does get back into tennis, though, which is one of the great things, at the 137th Street Y.
375th Street Y.
Oh, okay. Well, either way, it's too many numbers, isn't it? Too many streets in New York. A New York movie that isn't really New York. They deliberately have a shot where Kumar Palana Pagoda is standing in front of the Empire State Building. Or maybe it was the...
It's the Statue of Liberty.
That's the one, yeah.
But he's hiding it with his body. You can't see it.
Because Wes Anderson made him do that on purpose. He didn't want to be a typical New York travelogue. But anyway, yes, at the end, Richie gets back into tennis and it's playing with little kids, playing as well as he could as a champion-level player. Game! Chain sides! The funniest thing Luke Wilson has ever done. I watched that scene before we sat down here to make sure I had the line right. It is game, chain sides. And it's just so matter of fact. I'm sure Wes Anderson said to him, hit the ball as hard as you can. The kid's not going to touch it anyway. It's about 10 feet away from him.
Kid doesn't even try.
And then act like you just won a point against this kid.
He's so cutthroat.
What a great laugh. And at the end, yeah, you've got the whole thing where Royal's about to die. It's two scenes later because that happens. And then Ben Stiller's out with them and his kids on the garbage truck we'd seen earlier where Royal's out with the two grandkids, and now suddenly Chaz is behind them. But I think it's the next shot, it's something like that anyway, where Chaz is in the ambulance with Royal. He's the only one witness to his father's death, and he's the one that had the biggest problem with him, even more so probably than Gwyneth Paltrow's Margot character, the adopted daughter.
Seems to me like Chaz is the one that's the most messed up, but in fairness, he's also the one who's been widowed by a tragedy.
And I wrote down a note when we were watching the movie, why is he so paranoid when you first see him, or one of the first times you see him, his kids have to do the fire drill thing. Why is he so paranoid about that? His wife died in a plane accident. But that's just because I guess he doesn't want to lose them in any kind of way, whether it be something accidental or something stupid or anything like that.
After you lose somebody in an accident like that, it's that feeling that you think anything could happen. You never think something like that could happen to you, so it's kind of a thing of PTSD, this notion that anywhere around the corner, the next tragedy could be waiting. You and I feel pretty safe and insulated from that because it's been a long time since either of us has experienced a real tragedy in our lives. That's a typical thing. I love, love, love the scene, oh my god, his little boys, when he has moved back into the house with Etheline and he's setting them up in their bunk beds. Okay, good night. And then a split second later comes back and says, you know, I'm just going to sleep with you. Rolls out the sleeping bag to sleep on the floor, and his little boy climbs down and crawls up with him, and they're dressed alike and they're in the same position. And it's the most adorable, moving little family scene. And I love how it's kind of a reflection of Chaz's own childhood when his home family was blowing up with the divorce and the kids are acting like adults. He's running a family business. He's probably the reason that they've kept the house. They all seem to have these adult careers and they look after their parents whose lives are blowing up. And now Chaz is in a position where his little boys are acting like little grown-ups. You never see his little boys grieve their mother or really express many emotions at all compared to their father. They are really clearly aware that they have to humor him. You see it right away in the beginning with the whole fire drill thing.
And dressed like him, too. They're always dressed like him, including the black track suits during Royal's funeral.
I know.
The thing that affected me emotionally, and of course I've seen the movie many times, so it wasn't like it was some new thing, but it's when he says to Gene Hackman, Ben Stiller does at the end, I've had a hard year, Dad. I know you have, Chazzy.
I know.
Because finally he's connecting with his father. They only have that, well, two moments, I guess, that and then in the ambulance at the end. And on screen, maybe there's other scenes that we never saw. It implies that there are other scenes we never saw.
Well, there's other scenes, too, where they're arguing with one another, because he's the one who's always skeptical. You know, there's a moment almost when Royal fakes having a heart attack, and he's on the floor putting the wooden spoon in his mouth. And
Fuck you, care.
Yeah. And Chaz, for a moment, is like, hey, man, are you okay? He breaks that hardness.
And then he gets fucked you care.
Yeah, he gets fucked you care, and then he walks away. Of course, he's proven right. Royal is faking his illness just to get back in the family. And speaking of wonderful lines, he finally gets found out and he's getting kicked out and everybody's disgusted with him and they're just standing watching him leave the house. He says, well, you know, I want you to know this has been the best 6 days of my life. the narrator breaks in and says, right at that very moment, he realizes that what he said was true.
I love that line, too.
It's beautiful. Yeah. And that's the turnaround for Royal, and that's when he turns around. That's his growth in the film to go from being a son of a bitch to an actual real dad. He stops just caring about how it matters to him and how it will affect his life, and he starts caring about each of them as individuals and how to make their lives better, starting with granting Ethel a divorce.
I like that in that moment, though, too, with the line where Baldwin chimes in. Hackman plays it very slightly. Only we really could notice that. I don't think anybody in the scene would see the look on his face that implies that, because they're not thinking that he's thinking that line about how, hey, I really meant that. But when the narrator says that to us, you see it on his face where there's a bit of a change to say, wow, how about that? That's awesome. I actually feel that way. And also the melancholy of, oh, shit, I really feel that way, and I'm losing my family all over again.
Yeah.
And there's also that lovely moment where he says to the boys and Chaz, anyone feel like picking up burgers and going down to the cemetery? And then they don't do it, but he goes, and you see him standing in front of not his mother's grave, but his daughter-in-law, who I guess he never met, Chaz's wife's grave, by himself. He did it. No one's watching him. He's not doing this for points. He did it because he felt like he should.
Sorry about your mother. She was a terribly attractive woman.
The funny thing is, and people have probably heard this story by now, I'd never heard it until more recently, though, that Gene Hackman and Wes Anderson really did clash in this movie. I guess Hackman was a bit of a dick. Maybe he's always been, and I never really heard stories about it. It was towards the end of his career. This is one of the last movies he ever did. I wish it had been his last movie. That would have been awesome. He made maybe three, four more, including one this same year with Owen Wilson behind Enemy Lines, which was dog shit. His last movie, Hackman's, was Welcome to Mooseport. And I think that's when he said, okay, enough of this. I don't want to do this shit anymore. And he has literally retired. There's nothing in his resume since 2004. And since he's 87 years old, I think in a couple more days, I think it's late January, he's obviously not going to come back to making movies now. But he could have ended on this note. And you say that about a lot of actors. Nobody really ends on the right note, I suppose. Look at Nicholson's last movie. It's going to be How Do You Know? Which was a favorite of Jim Brooks, his longtime friend.
He probably thought that was going to be a good movie.
He could have ended with A Bucket List, which isn't a great movie, but it ends with, spoiler alert, A Bucket List, him and Morgan Freeman dying and reaching all these great goals and making friends together. I don't love that movie, but that would have been a nice way for him to go out. But back to Hackman and Anderson clashing. I guess part of the whole thing with Hackman was the old school thing versus this neurotic guy who's a little bit too, I don't know, feminine exactly, but be a man, I think at one point he said to him. And Bill Murray, who'd already become really close with Wes Anderson and obviously has been ever since, every movie that Wes Anderson's made, Bill Murray's been in it, even a small role. I read that Murray was protecting him as best he could, and other actors maybe did as well. I don't know if Hackman was going to do anything to Wes Anderson, but they really did clash in that sense. And the funny thing is, Hackman was the best thing in this movie, and it's got a great cast and great design and all the rest of it, so that's saying a lot, great script. And this is not a guy known for comedy. A lot of actors were cast against type in this, including Bill Murray himself at that point, I would say. Paul Tro playing the downer, the golf sullen...
kind of, yeah.
And then Danny Glover playing the nebbishy nerd.
Yeah.
And then Hackman as well. None of these people had really played characters like that before. And Hackman had done comedy a few times in his entire career, including Get Shorty, which I love. You're not a big fan of that one. That was about 6 years before this. But this is not a guy known for being funny. And yet in both movies, he's very funny. I don't think he recognized that he could play comedy very well. Maybe he didn't see it on the screen. Burt Reynolds didn't see how good and how funny he was in Boogie Nights. He badmouthed the movie, and though it got him a nomination and brought him back.
Gene Hackman initially turned it down, so Wes Anderson tried to give the part to, oh my god, another Gene. Was
Gene Wilder.
Gene Wilder, thank you.
It's a Gene thing, I guess.
Yeah, and Gene Wilder also turned it down, and I guess in the meantime he talked Gene Hackman into doing it. He said he wrote the part with him in mind. I can't picture anyone else playing Royal Tenenbaum. Yeah. He is so hysterical. He's so, so funny. But also, the pathos is there. You know, it's real. And that montage with him and the two little boys set to that great Simon Garfunkel song, Me and Julio Down by the Schoolyard. Yeah. And it's, they're doing, like, all these reckless things. Like, truly reckless things. Mm-hmm. Running in front of traffic. Starting fights and playing dice and all these terrible things.
Riding in the back of the garbage truck is not very safe either.
No, no. And you really believe that moment that he's just having so much fun. And when he says the line, this is the best week of my life, those are the moments that you conjure and you think about. His relationship with those little boys feels so real, and so many things about it just feel so genuine. Comedy is commitment. He's selling this role. He's playing it almost as if it's real, that he really is this total son of a bitch and he's not exaggerating.
It's funny to hear then that he didn't like working with Anderson. I don't know if he disliked the movie the way that Burt Reynolds seemed to dislike Boogie Nights. But if he did, he's not seeing his own work. This is a guy we've covered three times before. Bonnie and Clyde, French Connection, Unforgiven. There may be humor here and there in those movies with his character, but not really. Those are very dramatic performances. So look at the range the guy is showing here. But then maybe it's not as much range as we're saying. He was apparently a bad dad himself, so art imitated life.
Hmm.
He was drawing on things he'd already done with his own family, I suppose. And we should hate him for so many reasons, but because of the humor and because it is a star we've seen for so many years, the guy had been around for, at that point, 35 years or something, that's probably what makes this work. If this was some documentary, you'd probably hate the guy. But because it's a great Hollywood star, you'll like him more.
They don't work that hard to make him lovable, really, until he's redeemed at the end. They go out of their way to remind us that he's a bad father. He deserves all their anger.
All right, well, the story is set in the present, and that's evidenced by the library book at the very beginning, and also Royal's gravestone. It is set in 2001. But, of course, it looks like the past. That's a nice touch, because you could actually think it is the past. A lot of people probably think this is a period piece. The cabs, for one thing, look like they're from 40 or 50 years ago, not just 20 or 30.
They look like they went to the wrecking yard and came back already.
They found one cab to look at that, and this is the best we could find, Wes. That's what we'll go with. I can see that maybe being
the case. There's a dent in this car. And another one, and another one.
Now, as for that house that everyone loves in this movie, and they should, I don't blame them for all moving back in, because why would you leave such an awesome house?
Oh my God, it's amazing.
And then their dated clothes that they always wear. They're wearing costumes, of course, they're actors, but the costumes in the movie are costumes for the characters, because they wear the same, if not the exact same outfit, similar enough the whole way, especially Stiller wearing those Adidas tracksuits, and his sons for that matter too, wearing the red the whole time until the black ones at the very end.
But it's funny you bring him up, because he's one of only two characters that changes their costume at any point in their life. When Chaz is a kid, he dresses in a suit.
Oh, that's true.
And then suddenly when he's grown up, after his wife dies, his costume changes to the Adidas tracksuit. And they never explain it. You assume that the change took place at some point there. The other character that changes their costume is Eli Cash, played by Owen Wilson.
But not a Tenenbaum.
Not a Tenenbaum. And when he's a little boy, he dresses in a suit. It kind of looks like a school uniform. And when he's grown up, he dresses like Midnight Cowboy, like John Boyd in Midnight Cowboy. But then it's interesting, in the past, he's at Margot's birthday party, and he's wearing his pajamas, which are a fringed kind of cowboy outfit.
Okay.
And when they do the flashback to Margot, every relationship she ever had in her life, when the private detective finds all the men she's ever kissed, and women, there's the shot of her with Eli Cash. In that scene, he's not dressed at all like he's dressed in the present. Yeah. He is wearing the same uniform, like his costume, for when he was a little boy.
He's wearing
a blue suit jacket with a light blue shirt.
And wearing the glasses. That can be applied. That was many years before. And then she went on her adventures.
It was 2 years before. They said specifically it was 2 years before. Okay. Yeah, yeah. Right. That was his costume as a little boy. And then when he becomes a famous author, he decides to wear his pajama costume, like his alter ego, where he becomes the cowboy.
But the shorthand is there with the outfits they all wear that are basically the same. Richie wearing his headband so much in the movie, and then having that long hair till he cuts it off.
Margot, a little girl in a fur coat.
Yeah.
Riding the bus in a fur coat.
And how about the costumes and sets for those Family Guy-esque asides, including the one where you see Royal as a middle-aged man, not an older man, saying, "This is my adopted daughter, Margot." What's that scene? 5 seconds long? The budget was not that big in this movie. That must have cost big bucks, though, to go back and just shoot that little aside. And the ones you've mentioned already about showing her and her various husbands, that was not a very long sequence, probably 4 or 5 different shots and different sets and costumes each time.
I can't for the life of me figure out how he can afford to make the movies the way he makes them. He's a rich kid. He's always had money. He's a member of the leisure class. I wonder if he's just his whole life been collecting all these antiques and vintage things, and they become part of the sets when he's imagining these wonderful set pieces. And you could just freeze any frame and study it and notice all these details, and they carry through from one scene to the next. There's a scene where you see Richie playing with his little toy cars, and then when you see him as an adult on the cruise that he's taken to get away from Margot, who he's in love with after he has his mental breakdown, those little toy cars are on the cruise with him. They're in the background, you barely see them, but if you're paying attention, then you'll notice. I mean, you could watch this movie every day of the year and still notice things every single time you watch it that you never saw before.
And not just in the house, as you're pointing out.
No,
right? The cruise ship.
The detail is so rich, and there's so many little Easter eggs. It's everywhere. And that's part of what makes it such a wonderful movie and so watchable over and over again. I understand that it's not for everybody, and it can seem gimmicky to a lot of people, but man, it works on me.
One of the reviews I read back in 2001, it may have been Salon, but whoever it was that didn't love the movie did say they loved the Dalmatian mice. And the way that they did that was took a Sharpie and just dotted up some white mice. That's not that impressive a detail. Anybody could do that. It wouldn't take that much time or attention. But it's still a pretty great dedication to the cause.
And then
he gets an actual Dalmatian dog at the end. Mm-hmm. Royal buys a dog to replace Buckley. Wes Anderson always kills the dog. Or no, it's a cat in Grand Budapest Hotel. It's a dog in Moonrise Kingdom. Thank you.
There's also a lot of suicides in this movie, or at least Owen Wilson had just attempted suicide in real life not long before Darjeeling Limited. I don't remember if there was anything like that in the movie. There wasn't, I guess. No, sorry. His character does have that backstory. Right. That's right. Yeah. So he had done it in real life, and it's in the movie.
That's how he convinced his brothers to go on the trip with him, right?
So maybe there isn't that much suicide attempting, but Richie in this movie, and then his brother Owen a couple of movies later. And then we mentioned major characters dying. That was one of the themes in the trivia question with Royal and with Ralph Fiennes, but also Owen Wilson, the co-star, not the main star, but the co-star in Life Aquatic, ends up dead. And then get that touching moment when they're all in the submarine and they all reach out to touch Steve Zissou, Bill Murray, because not long before, Owen Wilson's character had died.
As fantastical and storybooky as this movie's look, he doesn't shy away from these very grown-up nihilistic themes.
You got pseudo-incest and suicide and fraud, infidelity, lying, all joys of the season. And yeah, it's pretentious, but it's also fucking funny. With the bittersweet ending and some pretty great parting laughs at the end, including game chainsides.
Pretentious. Let's talk about this. This is a main criticism of the film, that it is just white, upper class, this kind
one
of
black
world.
Guy.
One black guy who... It's a small
Also his son, so there's two black people in the movie, at least. Oh, at the very end.
Okay. And he is sweet. Like, I really,
Danny
love
Glover
his character.
Is so adorable
God.
In this movie. You want to hug him.
He's just the most lovable character in cinema. You're so happy that they end up together. They're just the sweetest things. I mean, I keep saying the leisure class. None of these people have jobs. Like, Ethel and Chaz seem to be the only people that work in the whole film. And it's never addressed how they just get away with going on a cruise for 2 years, living in a hotel for decades.
Well, Richie was a tennis star. He could have built up an awful lot of money in that bank account.
Okay, but I grew up normal middle class. You grew up normal, even like almost working class. Do you know anyone who took tennis lessons? Even tennis as a sport is kind of an upper class sport. It's not... equestrian, but...
No, but you wonder how rich he could go on a cruise and pay for it, because he probably built up millions of dollars from being a tennis star.
It's still a very hard thing to relate to as an audience member, when, like...
Oh, I know.
Margot just won't get out of the tub for, we presume,
because she's
months
married
on end.
And she is bilking off of Bill Murray's character.
Well, and she comes from a wealthy family, and maybe she made money off her plays.
Yeah.
Even Ethel's mission to educate her children, all those lessons that those kids take... are expensive. A lot of people don't do that with their children because they simply can't afford to. And even though Ethel has a job when we meet her in the present, it's hard to imagine that she could have done all those things and worked when she was a single mother.
Well, she's a good mom, and she's as good a mom as Royal is a hilariously terrible father.
Mm-hmm.
We don't see a ton of Ethel actually mothering these kids, but then there is that line that you love so much, and I quote a few minutes ago in my introduction, "Well, I think you should quit," when she finds out that Margot is smoking.
Well, and the point
she
is
actually cares about her.
You know, she cares about her, but it's funny that Margot's been keeping this secret for 20 years that she smokes, and then when people find out, they're just like, "Oh, well, stop it." You know, nobody's like, "You kept this a secret from me for all these years." Nobody's really as shocked as probably Margot wishes they were.
Mm-hmm.
And Margot keeps these secrets almost as a revenge for always feeling like an outsider. Fine, I'll prove I'm an outsider and keep all these things from you and keep you in the dark about my life. But the truth is, their reaction to the secrets are just to worry about her health. Ethel especially obviously loves her.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that both her brothers love her, one more appropriately than the other.
Her adopted brothers. Angelica Houston has been great in a lot of things, including, of course, Morticia in The Addams Family and then The Grifters, where she's fantastic as a grifter. And we briefly starred in Cuckoo's Nest, too, when we covered that. She's one of the people in the dock when they all go out with the boat.
Oh, yeah.
Because Nicholson was dating her by that
That's
point.
Right.
Ben Stiller, I'll say this about him. He's made so many movies. He's been around a long time. He's directed, he's produced, he's acted, he's written. If he ever makes a funnier movie than Tropic Thunder, then my hat will be so far off to him I can't even have any more hats in my head ever.
Yeah.
I love that movie so much. He wrote, directed, produced that, and, of course, stars in it. He's hilarious in it. The whole movie's great. Gonna have to watch it again soon. Gwyneth Paltrow, we covered her in 7. I almost said this year. Well, that was last year now. And, of course, she won the Oscar for Shakespeare in Love, and now she's a social media pariah.
Pariah, my.
She's hated.
Well, yeah, she's also incredibly popular and successful.
Yeah, she's also hated by an awful lot of people. That's
yeah, I know.
I
people really do hate her.
Those who like her, but there's a lot of people that hate her.
I don't really get it.
She's a woman. How dare her tell people how to live?
She's also, bitch. I mean, we're talking the rich people. Like, she's very insensitive about what the actual lives might be like of the plebs who read her website every day.
She does come across as snooty that way, but I've always liked her as an actress, and that's the bottom line anyway. I think she's been good. Although, ironically, she's only made Mordecai, and she's been in a few TV episodes since Iron Man 3 in 2013. She's not retired, but she's barely done anything in 3+ years now. Luke Wilson, the less talented of the two Wilsons, but he's very good in this movie. And Richie's suicide, I think, is unintentional foreshadowing of Owen's attempted suicide, at least in the on-screen way, not in reality.
Owen wrote the script. He was one of the screenwriters, so suicide rarely comes out of nowhere. I think probably most people who attempt suicide have had suicidal thoughts or are familiar with it.
Be curious to know if that was his contribution to the screenplay, then.
Speaking of his contribution to the screenplay, Owen Wilson is an actor who's had off and on success. Mm-hmm. He's had movies that people have loved, and he's had movies that people have hated. And then it's curious that he then writes himself a character who's very popular but critically criticized. While Owen Wilson was very popular for a period of time there, critics kind of rolled their eyes at his contribution. So I wonder if that was like a
art imitating life. Yeah, and he's a bit of a shitheel as well. Maybe he feels like he's a shitheel in reality. He'd been in Shanghai Nights, I think it was the year before this, with Jackie Chan. A lot of people loved the movie. Other people that didn't like the movie very much was a Shanghai Noon. Shanghai Noon was the first one. Yeah, Shanghai Nights was a sequel. And those that didn't like that movie commented on the fact that he was this modern guy doing his Owen Wilson drawl kind of thing and just being Owen Wilson rather than actually playing a character. But then so many actors have made millions of dollars by playing themselves. He's done it too. He does have a huge resume. He's been in so many movies. And he's done a lot of them with Wes Anderson, although not so much the last couple of years. Wes Anderson's made not that many movies, I guess, the last few years. Anyway, Darjeeling Limited was the last one I think they made together, maybe? 2007?
Well, he was in Grand Budapest Hotel for like a split second.
Oh, I forgot that he was in that.
When they do like the whole brotherhood of concierges and they're all...
Which is Bill Murray's role. Yes, very small role, but he's in it.
Oh no, Jason Schwartzman's in the whole movie as the crummy concierge, right? Mm-hmm. But I think he's one of the brotherhood's concierges. Mm-hmm.
Bill Murray, of course, is in this, Groundhog Day, Ghostbusters, Lost in Translation. We covered all of those the last year or two. He is based on Oliver Sacks, the actual doctor, and it's, again, going against type for Bill Murray because, well, then again, he'd started being this less is more kind of guy by this point, but he's not really all that funny. He doesn't get many laughs. His scene player, Stephen Lee Shepherd, who's only been in a few things ever, the guy who played Harris on Freaks and Geeks, this, and a couple little spots and other things, and that is all. But the guy who plays Dudley in this, those two are fun together. But Dudley gets the laughs, like when he's covered in Richie's blood and he comes out of the emergency room, and they say to him, "Where is he? Who?" So that guy gets the laughs, Bill Murray not so much. But Bill Murray, of course, is in every Wes Anderson property, and sometimes he's great, and sometimes he's just a very small part of it, like in Grand Budapest.
I read that he was disappointed when he saw how small the part was, that he and Wes Anderson hit it off so much making Rushmore, and he's like, "I'm going to put you in my next movie," and I guess he assumed that he would have played Royal.
He would have been good as Royal.
He would have been good as Royal, I agree.
Not a lot of guys would have been as good as Hackman, but he would have been pretty close, I think.
It would have been a different movie with him as Royal, but I could see it happening, but... The director wants to go with something different. I don't blame him. And it's a great movie. I'm not complaining.
And he's still good in his role. He's also a saint for loving Margot through all that he loves her through. In fact, when he knows he's been made a cuckold and doesn't toss her aside, he's still a part of things. And also helping his romantic rival, Richie. Although I don't know if he knows then that Richie's a romantic rival, but he is trying to help him out because he's a good guy.
I love that scene when he's telling Richie, "I think she's cheating on me." And Richie's the one who rages out and breaks a window with his fist.
And then not long after, "I'm going to kill myself tomorrow." He does it minutes later. Needle in the Hay.
And that brings us to the soundtrack.
Great the soundtrack.
Incredible soundtrack. I mean, Wes Anderson has this very specific and wonderful taste in music. And yes, very upper class white sensibility.
But good songs. Who cares if they're white?
Oh, but like great songs, amazing tracks. It's not hard to find a Simon and Garfunkel song, but he chooses "Me and Julio." He chooses the one that if you ever knew about it, you probably forgot about it until it came out in this movie. And he does actually pick pretty popular Clash songs, but then he also picks "Police and Thieves."
Yeah. But also like, "Hey Jude" and "Ruby Tuesday." And "Hey Jude" is a great cover.
Yes.
Not the Beatles, but somebody else covering it. And it's lovely. I love that version.
And all those great... I love the Velvet Underground because I was a moody teenage white girl once upon a time. So the Nico stuff. Oh, just so beautiful and so well used, too.
I downloaded Everyone by Van Morrison the day after we watched this movie.
The song plays during the funeral.
Van
Morrison.
Many
directors, if they're going to pick a Van Morrison song, they would just pick Into the Mystic or
Sweet Thing.
Sweet Thing, Brown Eyed Girl.
Which is a great song. Brown Eyed Girl's been used by,
I mean, come on,
727,000 directors by this point.
And that's my point. Yeah. And I guess Hey Jude, come to think of it, has probably been used.
But it's not the Beatles. It's a cover of the Beatles.
Sure,
so it's even
better.
And let's not forget the Peanuts music that's used plenty of times.
That's right. And Mark Mothersbaugh is the composer for the film. He was a member of Devo, and he makes this great, very specific soundtrack, and again, very twee with the... I can't even describe it, but I will say this. Shortly after this movie came out, I spent a short time working in advertising. Every time we would mock up a commercial, editing a commercial, they would substitute some kind of music that they wanted the composer to copy. Mm-hmm. At that time, which was about 2004, 2005, I think one third of the ads were using some Mark Mothersbaugh track from a Wes Anderson movie. It was very, very popular. It was just considered high class, cool.
Rushmore may have been one of the ones you were using because
definitely.
Did compose for Rushmore as well, which is most people's favorite movie. Not most, but a lot of people's favorite movie that Wes Anderson's ever made.
Actually, I think probably most people's favorite Wes Anderson movie is Fantastic Mr. Fox, which we haven't mentioned yet.
That's
people always kind
great.
Of forget about it because it was stop motion animation, but oh my god. I mean, he's so inspired by Roald Dahl. All of his movies kind of feel like they were written by Roald Dahl in a way, but for grown-ups, it's a natural thing for him to do a Roald Dahl story as a film. It's such a perfect match, and oh my god, everything about it. The casting, the animation, the characters, of course, all the set design is
How
amazing.
How did I not remember to say that one is one of my favorites? Okay, that's way up there. Maybe second, actually, behind Royal Tenenbaums. Then that, and then Grand Budapest. The editor, Dylan Titchener, cut Boogie Nights, Brokeback Mountain, which we covered, and There Will Be Blood, which we covered. He's edited for some pretty major players the last 10 or 15, 20 years.
A hell of a resume.
Mm-hmm. That's only three movies, too. Well, four, including this one. And the cinematographer, Robert Uemann, who always works with Wes Anderson, and he also did shoot Ghostbusters, the new one, which we just watched, finally, on DVD. The Girlbusters movie is okay. It's not terrible.
Yeah.
It's not wonderful. It does have some laughs.
I really
like Kate McKinnon. I want to see her do more things. But Jesus Christ, people, just like Suicide Squad, which I watched this afternoon, finally see them both on video. Neither of them is terrible. Neither of them is wonderful. But they're not that bad. So shut the fuck up, you haters.
People hated Ghostbusters before they even had a first draft of the script.
Because they dared to be women making that movie.
Yeah.
The movie is 2:35:1. We watched the Criterion Blu-ray, which I bought specifically for this. Looked pretty damn good and really had that pink popping right off the screen. This guy loves to use pink.
It's beautiful. I mean, we cannot exaggerate just how pretty this movie is. Just how aesthetically pleasing it is.
And Owen Wilson, who co-wrote with Anderson, also co-wrote on Bottle Rocket, which was the breakup for both of them, and Rushmore. But Owen's gone off to do other things ever since. I'm sure they're still friends, but they're not really making movies the same kind of way of being in that writer's room, slugging out these screenplays together. Producers were Anderson himself, Barry Mendel, and the super producer, Scott Rudin, whose name is on so many projects. He is a Harvey Weinstein in his own right. He doesn't have his own studio, but that guy has produced a lot of movies in the last 20 or so years. Okay, the influence, there's not that much, apart from Anderson's own filmography, because I would say this firmed up that twee tone after Rushmore, and it had the style that people either loved or criticized so much, but it did offer the opportunity to look at all those details when you watch the movie more than once.
Mitchell Hurwitz, who created Arrested Development, said he almost canned the idea after seeing Royal Tenenbaums because someone's already done it. But, you know, it took influence. He said that the voiceover, famously done by Ron Howard in Arrested Development.
Ever.
Right, but he said that that was kind of inspired or informed by Royal Tenenbaums. Certainly you can see when you make the connection between the two, even though they're very different, that they kind of live in the same world. They kind of have the same
style. They're not that different.
No, yeah, there's a lot of absurdity, and there's a wit that they both share. And also Alec Baldwin, who is the narrator in Royal Tenenbaums, calls it one of his favorite films, and based the character of Jack Donaghy from 30 Rock on Gene Hackman's performance as Royal.
Oh, wow, okay. Another great comedy in the 2000s would be 30 Rock. Well, back to Arrested Development, though, one of the other great comedies in the 2000s, not so much that single season they did a couple of years ago, but the comparison to Royal Tenenbaums, the Dangerously Broken Family with big laughs, and then the Peanuts music that both of those use. And then, of course, they have people trudging home with their head down like Charlie Brown would do with that forlorn music playing in the background. Another thing that Anderson does a lot in influencing himself in his own films is he uses the names and histories of people that he knows, including the name Tenenbaum, who was a friend of his, and he wanted to just use that name. He liked it so much. No one ever calls him Roy, by the way, as you think they would. I like that touch, that it doesn't sound like somebody's name, but it is.
Well, in the title of the film, you would never call a family the Ryan Ellis's. You would call them the Ellis's. So the title itself also implies...
you should call it the Ryan Ellis's.
Some people have called me Mrs. Ryan Ellis, so...
Some people are still stuck in the past, much like this movie. Stuck in the past. The only awards and list thing I got is the nomination for the screenplay, and it didn't win. Lost to Gosford Park, which is a good movie and a good screenplay. Maybe in a great one, actually, but this one, I guess, lives on more. We gotta watch Gosford Park one
day. I know, we keep saying that.
The upstairs, downstairs of the Robert Altman set. What a great cast that's got, as this one has. Great cast. That was the year of great cast, I guess every year is, but Tenenbaums, Gosford Park, Lord of the Rings, Harry Potter, all of those movies had so many great actors, so many great English actors in those other movies, not so much this one. All right, well, our last thoughts on Royal Tenenbaums. A good choice and a first one for Bev in the month of Bev.
Yeah.
Hit it.
Oh, okay, so as fantastical as this movie can get at times, I think that its enduring strength is this nugget of warmth and relatability. It certainly is easier for some people to come to than others, and few of us can relate to any of the specific things that a family goes through, but I think that each of us has some kind of metaphorical BB shot lodged in our hands. All of us have had our families both come through for us and let us down tragically at some point in our lives, and that's what makes this movie so beautiful and fun and easy to return to over and over again.
I really agree. This movie is a hell of a thumbs up, and I don't know why people don't like it more than they do. Because people like it, but they don't like it as much as they should, I think. Rushmore's fine. Yeah. I'm not a Jason Schwartzman guy. That's one of the reasons I don't like that movie that much. But Fantastic Mr. Fox. Gotta watch that again soon. Thank you for planting that in my head. Before we go, I gotta say one more thing about a recent project we've been doing. We talked about this on A Christmas Carol late last year. And you've heard this if you're fans of ours, but I got to promote it somewhere, so here it is. Yeah, check out our YouTube snippets. We've put several online by this point. We usually post one on a Tuesday and a Thursday or a Wednesday and a Friday, something like that. And what it is basically themes. Sometimes a reasonably good questions thing we've done a few times, but in snippet form, and we're hoping people to stumble across us and discover our podcast.
Yeah, we take excerpts that we like from the podcast.
And if we could find a way to compare other movies to movies we've covered from before, like with the very first one we did, Vertigo and Taxi Driver, with their Are They Real endings, then we'll do that too. So we've got a few online. Keep on checking those out. Just go to the website, and I'll include a link there for that, as I include lots of links for everything else that we covered that's interesting. Or not interesting. So when we check in with you again in 7 days, we're going to cover two movies in one. We've previously reviewed two Tarantino titles, of course, Pulp Fiction and Reservoir Dogs, his first two. Now it's a double shot of Bev's favorite QT films, Kill Bill. All right, the coming attraction trivia for Kill Bill. Another death-themed question this week. How many members of the Divas does the bride actually murder?
Oh, I can answer that right now, but I will make you wait until next week's podcast for Kill Bill. If you're a fan of the movie, you shouldn't have to think too hard about that.
Pretty simple one. Little slam dunk.
But what a great movie. I can't wait for that one. So for the answer to that, please check out next week's podcast. In the meantime, if you'd like more from Ryan and me, please check out our website, top100project.com. Don't forget to subscribe to the Top 100 Project on iTunes. And while you're there, check out our entire roster of podcasts. We've covered 190-ish movies, including all 123 movies that made AFI's 1998 and 2007 lists of the best American movies ever made. Every episode's available for free, and while you're there, rate us, review us, it helps people find us. And if you'd like to reach Ryan and me, we are both on Twitter. I'm at Bev Ellis Ellis, and Ryan is at MovieFiend51. And once more, we would like to thank our sponsor, Sparkplug Coffee.
Let's shag ass.
And cut.